The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the renowned website builder that helps you share your story with the world in the most beautiful way. Establish a personal brand, portfolio, or e-commerce store at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Football Weekly Extra.
Listeners, we're here to help. Got a little bit of international amnesia, confused about what on earth's been happening, about all those international qualifiers that we were last interested in before Christmas, right? Well, we're going to be going through the groups and the matches that matter. England's big match with Lithuania, the showdown in Amsterdam as Goose takes on Turkey. It's the Avian Derby. There's a little bit of Group E love too. Hey, I thought our live show was tomorrow. And then we'll be moving on to your questions and indeed answers. All that, plus the most exciting quota talk since got trapped in a lift with a man doing the dead parrot sketch in today's Football Weekly Extra. Internationals. Paul McKinney is over there. Internationals.
Oh, hi there. Were you looking at me with an expectation I might have something to say? Well, I was just trying to familiarise myself with these tables I haven't looked at for 6 months.
I know. It's like, if you'll excuse a metaphor, it's like when you're about 30 pages from the end of a really good book, like, but somebody snatches it away and gives you one that you were last interested in around about, what was it, October last year, November?
But you felt that you should finish.
Yeah, oh, I suppose I ought to go back and do that. And it turns out it was a thrilling read. I mean, I'd forgotten. And Ian, I'm heartened to know that you'd forgotten too.
Yeah.
Ian McIntosh, by the way, everyone.
Hi.
Hey. And that's Simon Burton.
Yes,
that silence over there, that's Simon Burton. Good. Anyway, sorry,
I have
Ian.
Terrible international amnesia. And that's really bad because it looks like all the British teams have been doing really well.
Yeah, they have.
That's marvellous.
Quietly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who knew?
I don't know.
Well, apparently me, about 2 or 3 months ago. And then it drifted.
I guess there's so much information that there must be. Our minds are probably a little bit, you know, those hard disks, like, for example, on your TiVo or Skype, that they just loop round. So the more information you cram in on, say,
video technology.
Exactly. All the other stuff from last just drops out the back.
This is basically season 3 of Game of Thrones, which is still sitting at the back end of my hard drive.
Have you not seen season 3?
Oh, my word.
I got freaked out when they... And I had to have a bit of a break.
Whew, we haven't had the spoiler klaxon in ages,
my
Ian.
My humble apologies.
That's all right. Producer Ben's got your back. Anyway, the whole qualifying process, it's like Game of Thrones, I suppose. That's a metaphor you can run with.
Well, absolutely.
All right.
In the Game of Thrones, you either win or you don't go to France.
Exactly. But by and large, you go to France because pretty much everyone goes to France. Simon, you've been sitting there, you know, enigmatically.
Yeah.
Sagely. Because you remember everything, don't you? You probably remember exactly how good England have been. It's one of their best qualifying runs, well, since probably the last one.
Well, they did win in Switzerland in relatively handsome style, which is basically what that was demanded of them in this qualifying group.
That was a tough game.
That looked to be the tough game. Safely negotiated, and now onwards and upwards we go.
All right. Well, since then, San Marino have fallen under the wheels of the Roy Hodgson machine. San Marino, Estonia, Slovenia, now mighty Lithuania.
But the question, I guess, this week, what makes this week special is Harry Kane, whether he can destroy yet another branch of football. Own another branch of football. He's taking it internationals now. Mm. He's done the Premier League.
He's one of our own.
Well, yes, he is.
Yeah, very much so. Mm. Well, it's exciting. Yeah, there's a kind of feel-good factor to the England squad with his inclusion. What about the rest of the team? Anything else we should take note of?
I noticed Alan Shearer today saying that England's striking lineup is now their best in 20 years, now that Kane is on board to add to Rooney, Sturridge, Welbeck.
Mm.
Austin.
Is it really better than Alan Shearer and Michael Owen?
Well,
I mean, that was pretty good.
Basically, he's saying the best since Shearer, Owen, Sheringham, Ferdinand, etc. and so forth.
As such, does it not represent a really bad timing from Greg Dyke to wade in with his quota to help improve the quality of English players that we're then able to furnish to the national team?
I think no, because I think any opportunity to get that talking point talked about is should be used.
Are you in favour of it, Paul?
I think I am. I'm because I think I fundamentally agree with the basic point he makes that for fans, particularly fans who pay money to watch football, where is the Englishness in the English game that's going to that English fans are going to be able to identify with? That's the point that Dyke makes, and I think that's a fair one. I think that's a long way down the road, and it's a different point from do we have enough elite players to make the England squad, because you only need 18, I guess. I do think it's a. I do think it's an issue. I do think we are going down that way. And you know, the fact of the matter was there was only one guy in the Liverpool Manchester United match who was born within 5 miles of Anfield, and that was Wayne Rooney last weekend. And I think that does make a difference.
Interesting. What's your take, Ian?
It's going to be a very, very hard sell. Premier League clubs don't really see themselves as national companies now. They see themselves as international companies. They see the entire world as their scouting jurisdiction, and telling them that they're going to have to essentially pick weaker players. It's going to be very, very difficult to convince them, because where's the game for them? They don't care about England. Why would they care about England?
And it's one of the reasons that the Premier League has been able to sell at such incredibly inflated prices the product abroad, and yes, I did just call it a product, is that you're able to get the world's best stars. I mean, I think quota advocates would say you will still get the best in. It's the mid-tier players you wouldn't have in.
Mame Biram Diouf that you won't see so much of.
Right, it seems a bit harsh on him. But Simon, I don't know what your thoughts are. Basically, Greg wants to have a stricter quotas on what players you're... and tougher restrictions from the Home Office about allowing players in.
Yeah, well, I think it's difficult. Having established the Premier League as a place of unfettered commercialism, they will obviously attempt to steer clear of any fetters. One thing that does seem a good idea is changing the definitions of a homegrown player. At the moment, if you play for 3 years before your 21st birthday, then you count as homegrown, which means that if you're signed at 18, that you can be classified as a homegrown player. The likes of Fabregas famously were Robert Huth. And his suggestion was to change that to 3 years before you're 18.
Right.
That seems very sensible to me. And if you're going to have homegrown player regulations, it would make sense to try and restrict them to players who were literally
not only
formed
would the
here.
Not only would the criteria be more stringent, but the numbers would be expanded, I believe. Now that squads would have to include more of these homegrown players,
but there's still plenty of space in his suggestions for quite a lot of foreign talent in the squad.
As you say, though, hard to imagine them, you know, by Zainergi's law of evolving dynamics, hard to imagine them cramming the Premier League corporate model back into a kind of more Corinthian straitjacket. But that case will be made, I believe, today. He's meeting the Premier League clubs today. So
it would at least represent a degree of joined-up thinking, because remember, a couple of years ago, they brought in EPPP, which meant that the big clubs could effectively just whisk away all young players from all smaller clubs for, I think it was some nominal fee that actually went up if anything happened. And there seems very little point in ravaging the lower leagues only to leave them to stockpile and waste. It would be nice if I'm a Southend United supporter. If my team's going to get screwed over, it would be nice if something actually happens at the end of it.
Right. I mean, that contradicts. I mean, I know you were putting the case rather than arguing for it, but that does kind of contradict what you were saying about essentially we are in an unfettered capitalist model here. That sentiment will not apply. The point of them taking all these players from lower clubs, their ultimate interest is if they don't say find a pearl amidst the dust, then they'll sell them on for more money than they ever invested on them, and then make a smaller profit.
I've got a question. Is EPPP the sexiest acronym I've heard all week? I think it is.
I don't know if anyone else uses it.
That's elite player
performance plan
program.
Program
plan.
No need for that now. Okay.
Oh.
All right. Wow. Well, look at this, listeners. England tick. Bit of talk about Greg Dyke's serious business tick. So let's move on to the exciting story of Wales, who are also doing really well. Look at that. Top of the group with Israel. Ooh, they're going to be visiting Saturday. Who's been following the Wales story then, Simon?
Well, it's all going off in Israel this week, which is rare to be able to say that.
Well, actually not, but
entirely sporting.
Right. Sorry, yeah.
Because not only are Wales visiting, but Belgium are visiting on Tuesday. And those are potentially definitive games in that group. Obviously, Israel and Wales are the top two teams at the moment. Belgium struggling in fourth place, playing catch-up.
Cyprus in third.
Yeah, well, they play Cyprus on Saturday, but to Belgium. who are one place above them, but not for long, you'd have thought. But yes, and two very interesting fixtures in Israel this week.
Yeah, and you might not think of Israel as that difficult an opponent, but they have qualifying's top scorers so far, Omar Damari.
Is it Omer?
There you
go. Omer Damari. That's Group B anyway. Right. We want to talk about Group C, where everyone thought Spain would probably do their usual qualifying romp. But think again, because they've already been beaten once. That's their first defeat in 36 European qualifiers.
They've already been beaten once.
Well, yeah, but they've only had four games. They've lost 25% of their matches so far. That was to Slovakia, who topped the group unbeaten. Spain have apparently an absolutely must-win game against Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, they're only 3 points off the top of the table, and they are coming back from the end
and
of the dream in the World
and
Cup.
Yeah,
it's very difficult to get eliminated from this group stage, I think.
I'll move on to Group D, where big people are going to drop out. Poland are top, three teams chasing them. One of them is Germany, another one is Scotland, and then the other one's Ireland. Scotland play Ireland next Tuesday. Before that, they've got Gibraltar on Saturday, I'm thinking, is it?
Yeah.
And you
I
saw them
so.
In action Wednesday night, Ian.
To be honest, I I was trying to do something else at the time, and I worried that the football might distract me, and it did not distract me in any way. So much so that I can pretty much only tell you who scored and how it happened.
All right. Who scored?
It was a very dull game. It was Berra with a header from a set piece in the 85th minute.
Right.
That's it.
Christoph Berra.
The very same.
Right. Ipswich is Christoph Berra.
There you go. How Scottish is he?
Born in Edinburgh.
Right.
Yeah.
Pretty Scottish.
Yep, that'll do.
Okay, well, that's a huge game. The Gibraltar game, not so much. And Germany, who have been having all sorts of terrible results and pretty much cruising along, having only won the World Cup very, very recently, they're away at Georgia.
But Republic of Ireland, Poland is the big match there.
Oh, the one that I completely missed out, the big match.
Yeah.
So before they play Scotland, they take on the group leaders Poland.
They do. They host them in Dublin.
Wow, that's
weekend.
A huge
so,
game.
Yeah, that's the big one.
Wow. All right.
And while it has been the case that some of, like, to talk Germany there and in Spain, you know, coming off the back of the World Cup, some nations have taken time to get into gear, have almost factored in a period where they can play at kind of half speed.
Mm.
That's allowed countries like Poland, who are slightly lower down on the tiers, but not too far off that top pecking order, to push on. And Poland have been in great form so far.
All right.
Isn't it weird that only one, what we shall loosely call, major European nation has bucked the trend? All the big nations have had problems coming off the World Cup. All the medium nations have done really well, apart from in Group E, where England look professional and polished.
Well, what about Italy?
Italy have dropped points, haven't they?
Well, maybe.
Is Group E not another example of a medium nation doing well?
Yeah. That's why I was so loose, fast and loose with the terminology.
Very nicely done, Simon. Hey, tell you what, there's more letters to come, and we'll be looking at those very briefly, listeners, before we get on to other meaty issues and a little bit of Netherlands talk in part two.
Hello everyone, producer Ben here to tell you about the brand new Guardian podcast series, which goes behind the scenes of our campaign, Keep It In The Ground. Here's a taster.
This is the biggest story in the world.
We will look back on these times and we will think, what on earth were we doing?
From The Guardian.
This is a story about people, and this is a story about possibility.
It's a story that's eluded us for decades.
It's clearly the most important story that we could be thinking about, and yet you scan the daily newspapers and it's almost absent.
A topic which The Guardian is now throwing itself wholeheartedly into.
I'd seen how we'd done it on other things.
Climate change. Is there a new way to make the world care?
That's the challenge. What can you do that will force them to sit up and pay attention?
The biggest story in the world on The Guardian.
Episodes 1 and 2 are now available. To hear them both and to get new instalments, subscribe at theguardian.com, biggest story podcast. And now, back to Jimbo.
Yep, we got up to F. Thank goodness there are only 26 letters in the alphabet, otherwise there would be no limit to Platini's
expansionist tendencies.
And Platini looked at Group Z and he wept, for he saw there were no more letters to have groups named after. Group F is the one that contains Northern Ireland, who've never played in the Euros. But, you know, they're in with a big chance, as everybody is this time. They've got a game against Finland this weekend. Romania are on top of the group. They host the Faroe Islands, etc. and so on. Winless Greece, it says here, are in desperate need of 3 points in Hungary. While Group G is all about Austria, Have I missed out any important fixtures there, someone?
Don't think so.
Okay. Austria, they're the team to beat there. They're going to Liechtenstein. And then Russia, who I think, are they down in fourth?
Third.
Oh, they're in third. Oh, yeah, but I'm reading this. There's too many things to look at. Well, Russia, they're going to Montenegro. That's been called a must-win game for Fabio Capello. And second place, Sweden face Moldova. Loads of fixtures. Let's talk about Group H, because that's got Italy in it, and it's really tight. The top three are all within a point of each other. Croatia ahead of Italy on goal difference. Italy, who are going to be taking on England next week in a friendly, they'll be playing Bulgaria. And, ooh, Robert Prozineski will be back in action as manager of Azerbaijan as they take on Malta. That's a very exciting group. Very exciting and very exotic. Italy, hello.
You were about to forget another key fixture.
Maybe I was saving it.
I was working as backstop there.
Oh, right.
But let's do Italy.
Italy against Bulgaria?
No, the key fixture I was talking about was Croatia-Norway.
Oh, right.
The two teams that are the bread in...
That's coming
up. Italy sandwich.
Very much so, yeah. Mm. And that's in Zagreb.
Indeed.
Yeah. Have you got high hopes for that game, Simon?
I once saw in the 1998 World Cup, mm-hmm. I went to see Norway play in the first knockout round in Marseille.
Okay.
And it was the most boring 2 hours of my life, and I've never looked forward to seeing Norway since.
Have you genuinely not had a more boring 2 hours?
I've had some pretty boring 2 hours, mm-hmm. but to be fair, I was sat right at the top of one of those stands. It's quite a gorgeous stadium, yeah. And the view is nice.
Yeah.
Whereas in France 98, I saw Scotland play Norway, and it was one of the best afternoons of my life.
What was so special about it?
Because it was just a city full of drunken Norwegians and Scots just running around with massive flags.
Right.
They are pretty much my two favourite nations of drunk people.
It had a party atmos, so it did in Bordeaux that day. And also, my dad was trying to dress like a kind of... Provençal sophisticat with a roll-up Panama hat.
Oh yeah!
And we got on this bus with a tartan.
Was he employing linen as well?
Yeah. And we got on this bus with this tartan army, and it was quite funny for my dad, who, when in England, is kind of broad Scots and kind of, you know, tough, hewn from porridge kind of guy. Mm. He was thoroughly metropolitan and cowed by the lads.
Can you hew
on the bus.
Porridge? I'm thinking granite's more.
Choose whichever element you like.
All right.
Just trying to create a picture.
Okay. Anyway, that's a big game then coming up, isn't it?
Who plays for Norway? Who's the stars for Norway? It's not Odegaard.
It is. It's already made an appearance for them, though, at the age of 16.
I think.
Four appearances.
Is he?
All right. Who else they got?
They've also got Dali, formerly of Cardiff, who was once very, very highly rated, but is now over at Freiburg.
Surreal prospect, isn't he?
Dui.
He looks surreal prospect. Yeah, yeah, anyway, we'll work on that. Come back to it.
They've also got Josh King, who I last saw
time
scoring...
Time just seems to stand still for him.
or just drips down the canvas.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. Josh King, who I last saw scoring a hat-trick against Stoke in the FA Cup, he is ludicrously fast.
Oh, is he?
Yes.
Josh King?
Yeah, I'm not sure he's actually particularly good, but he is
particularly
so
Norwegian.
Quick. No, he's Norwegian.
Is he?
But he's very, very quick. Stoke made the mistake of playing a particularly high and careless line, and Josh King just had the time of his life, just running into acres of space.
Right. We've all got that song playing in our heads. Yeah. Cool. But anyway, Italy. All sorts of excitement as they prepare to take on Bulgaria and then England in that friendly. They called up loads of foreigners.
Oh,
which I think shows creative thinking. Uriundi, as they call them, they're sparking the usual debate about whether, as, for example, Roberto Mancini says, you should only have players who were born in Italy play for Italy, or whether you should embrace the more modern concept of your nationality.
What other aspects of 1997 are still alive in Italy?
It's not really modern. Didn't Italy go big on the front in the 30s?
Absolutely. And they've won World Cups with them. Mm. I mean, most recently in 2006, Camoranesi. Mauro German Camoranesi wasn't actually German, but Argentine, as is one of the fellas they called up this time. The very exciting Franco Vasquez, who's pretty much the guy who loads up the ammunition for Paulo Dybala to score down in Palermo. Everyone's very excited about Dybala, but it's Vasquez who's pulling his strings in a very real sense. And the Brazilian, what's his name? Eder, of course. The Brazilian Eder as well, of Sampdoria, who's good in the air, as you know.
You'd hope.
But also scores a whopping free kick. And those are two very exciting players for a team that at the moment will probably be starting with Zaza and Immobile up front. and where Giorgio Chiellini is actually their top scorer. You know, but that works for Chelsea. On the subject of Italy, by the way, you may have seen, as indeed Judgment in May did, that there was some kind of verdict, as he puts it, on the Calciopoli scandal dating back to 2006, just after the World Cup, or kind of during it, when Juve were deemed guilty of putting pressure on referees and were stripped two titles and sent down to Serie B. Judgment in May says, can you guys clarify what Luciano Moggi, the kind of architect of it all, was acquitted of and what he wasn't? Well, basically, they didn't acquit him, but neither did they say he's guilty. What happened is the statute of limitations ran out. So at this point, they have the option of either saying, well, you know what, you're innocent, or saying you're not, but the case is closed because of the statute of limitation. So the next thing we all have to wait for is when the judge gives what they call the motivation. I don't know what the English term would be, but they hand out the explanation of this action. And that will set out whether, you know, overwhelmingly the evidence is that Moggi did run this kind of shadowy cupola, this network of influence and people who were making sure results went the right way. Basically, everybody was had the charges dropped because of the statute of limitations, except for one referee, Massimo De Sanctis, whose 1 year suspended sentence was upheld. And the suggestion is there that they had to keep at least one person as guilty, because otherwise they would have opened themselves up to an absolutely whopping lawsuit, which they may still do. €500 million of damages is what Juve have in the works for them, a case for that. So it's going to be interesting to see what the judge's kind of motivation is. Anyway, Group I, though, that's interesting as well. Only 5 teams in this group, and that means that leaders Denmark do not have a qualifying fixture, which is a shame because they're on a roll. They've just beaten USA 3-2. What was special about that game, Paul McInnes?
It was a hat-trick for Nicholas Bentner.
Nicholas Lord Bentner. Boom. Portugal can go top if they beat Serbia. Yeah.
Serbia, of course, who were pretty much out of contention and were last managed by one Dick Advocaat.
Oh, yeah. It's funny you should mention the Dick, because very, very shortly, in fact, right after this, I think we'll move on to a little bit of Mikael Jongsma to tell us about his prospective impact at the Stadium of Light and much more about the world of Dutch football.
This new year, make a resolution to dust off that big idea. This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the powerful platform that gives you simple tools to create a gorgeous website in minutes. With elegant templates, Getty image integration, and marketing tools, you can make your ideas resonate with the world. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Football Weekly Extra with James Richardson.
Alphabetically unchallenged listeners would have spotted that the group we haven't mentioned yet is Group A, which, we've got some surprises here. Iceland are in line to qualify for a major tournament for the first time, yet again. Ida Gudjonsson's back with them. All very exciting. But the big surprises are the Netherlands, who've been beaten by the Czech Republic and by Iceland. And next up, have a must-win game against Turkey. Boo! Without Arjen Robben, who's got that abdominal tear. Wow. Who can tell us more about this and other exciting Dutch football issues? Only Mikael Jongsma of Benefit.net, whose second time out from recording that rather excellent Eredivisie podcast, to join us now on the line. Hi, Mikael.
Hey, James. How are you?
I'm very well. In your laid-backness, you. Listen, I bet even you've got excited and pumped up over the match coming up this weekend, Turkey and Amsterdam. And what a delicate time. What's gone wrong for Gus Hiddink's side?
Well, he had huge boots to fill, of course, after Van Gaal's splendid play during the World Cup. And he's a little bit less hands-on than Van Gaal is. And he's very hands-on, as you've probably seen over the last few months in the Premier League. And that didn't seem to work for them, and he was just gambling with formations, just using 4-3-3, 3-5-2, 4-4-2, even in the most recent game to accommodate Huntelaar and Van Persie. So, yeah, it is kind of a big game. Turkey had beforehand probably the strongest team that the Dutch had to face, and now they are 2 defeats down already, and with a lot of people from Turkey living in the Netherlands, the stadium will be packed and the atmosphere will be electric.
Mikael, how much patience is there for for Gus Hiddink and the time it takes him to get the side right. I'm just thinking about Van Gaal when he arrived at Manchester United saying that it would take him months to find his team at John Ashtown last week, likening it to a man groping inside a Scrabble bag to find the right letters or at least arrange them in the right order. I mean, with international football, you have fewer games, so presumably it's going to take him that much longer to hit upon the right formula.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, some of the letters you'd like to use in Scrabble dropped out, and Van Persie and Iron Robin and Ron Flowers in there either. So these were three huge players for Van Gaal, very influential. So it's, I mean, he's kind of looking towards Huntelaar, Bas Dost possibly making his debut, Memphis Depay. So it's going to be a way different side. And there was a lot of pressure for the game against Latvia a few months ago, but they won that in style with 6-0. And now the pressure isn't as on as it was, because Hiddink kind of said, well, if we lose, I'm going to resign. And the Dutch press have asked him if it's the same for him now, and he has said, well, no, I'm staying nonetheless. So it's not as tense as it was, but you can't imagine the press turning on the screws when a bad result comes their way again.
Listen, Mikhail, there's a couple of other things that while we have you on the line, I wanted to ask you about. One is Dick Advocaat, who has arrived now, of course, at Sunderland, had his first game, didn't go well, but he'd only been there 3 days. With 14 days of preparation, Dick Advocaat plus Black Hats plus 14 days, does that equal success, do you think?
Well, he absolutely relishes the derby against Newcastle. He said when he was appointed, that was one of the things he was looking out for most. And he's absolutely thrilled to actually finally be in the Premier League. And I do think for a foreign manager to make his debut as a caretaker manager in the Premier League, it's kind of difficult. But he has the luck that he's obviously very experienced. Over the last 3 decades, has done something remarkable in every decade, and I think he kind of needs his big moments for this one. And his English is really good. I mean, he's played football in the United States. He's been a coach at Glasgow Rangers and a technical director. I think at Zenit, his main communication was in English as well. So he won't struggle with that aspect of taking on that role.
Mm. Hey, listen, Mikhail, the other thing I wanted to talk to you about is about actually Dick Advocaat's former side, AZ Alkmaar, and Billy Beane's arrival there. Now, this drew a certain amount of attention in the UK. I wanted to ask you, first of all, how involved is Billy Beane going to be at the club?
Well, he will just stay on as the manager at Oakland A's, as he did before. So it's basically going to be a couple of meetings in Alkmaar per year. So he's mainly staying in America, but as you can imagine, world press were all over it. So from a publicity kind of point of view, it's been a great success already. The main reason that Billy Beane is in is because Robert Einhorn, a former baseball player, contacted him about it. And it's a very interesting situation because whereas in the Premier League, and because I work at Arsenal, I'm kind of aware of this a bit more probably, a lot of teams do stuff with data. But in the Netherlands, it's kind of a novelty almost. And you had this press reaction of, oh, Billy Beane, the big baseball star, coming to the Netherlands to save football almost. Whereas a couple of days later, people were saying, well, he has never won anything, has he? So are his methods proven, and so on and so on. So it's kind of a double reaction, but it gained huge traction for the press, and I think people at RZ are really thrilled about the prospect of working with such a legend.
Yeah, well, as Billy himself points out, and as indeed was depicted in that rather excellent film Moneyball. Yeah,
that's actually quite funny, James.
Yeah.
One of the main reasons they got to him was because Ernie Stewart, former American international, he's got over 100 caps, I think, is one of the directors at AZ.
Oh.
And he went with the staff to the movie Moneyball and thought, oh, this is just amazing. We need to get this guy on board. And when he was talking about it with Robert Einhorn, he said, well, I actually know this fellow. So the film was very much instrumental in getting him there.
All right. Well, anyway, you all remember the Jonah Hill character, of course, knew nothing about baseball, but he was able to see things in a fresh light and therefore see ways around the conventional wisdom that ultimately benefited the Oakland A's. To what extent, Mikael, just lastly, is it Alkmaar the Oakland Athletics of the Eredivisie?
They are quite a small side in general. They have been overachieving quite a bit due to a rich owner they had until a few years ago when his company went bankrupt. But they've been very inventive in general, and they always seem to come up with new ways to punch above their weight, basically. They now have a lot of young players from their academy coming through, some very savvy signings. And from Deadlight, that is a revolutionary football club to some extent, in that they're very inventive and really being fit that picture. But I'm slightly skeptic about how much impact he's allowed to make, because I mean, with two meetings and some conference calls, I don't know if that will make the big impact.
Mikael Jongsma, the Women's Super League. Fifth season got underway Wednesday night.
It did.
All sorts of excitement on this, because building towards a World Cup next summer, which they are now going to do a Panini album for.
Are they?
I believe Is that
great,
right?
Great uproar.
There was uproar, and I'm pretty sure I've seen that there is, I don't know whether it's going to be a kind of an unofficial, a Blattini or something.
Well, I can tell you that we have an extensive preview on The Set Pieces,
really?
By the excellent Carrie Dunn.
All right.
Who got on the phone and spoke to some of the key players there. So. If you want a bit more information, The Set Pieces is your home.
Right, okay, some very exciting teams involved. Eight teams?
Yes, yep. In both divisions. The second division got started last week, I think.
Okay.
Or Premier League 2, right. As I believe it's called.
All right, well, it was quite a finale last time, you remember?
Yes, all the way down to the final moments, with the Liverpool players stood on the pitch in time-honoured fashion, waiting for phone calls from other places before they could celebrate.
Right, excellent. Now, we made a bit of a request for questions, if people had any... notes and queries and that they wanted answered or dealt with. And listeners have responded. They've responded in some style. They've also come in with some answers as well, which is very helpful. And let's go through the questions first of all. Here's ID078015. Question for Bob. Why are all of UEFA's anti-racism messages written in English? Isn't that a bit racist? Well, that's the whole, that's...
I mean,
you could argue
that, yeah. In fact, having one... in the international language is actually post-racial.
Not on this pod, you couldn't.
Okay.
The violent pacifist.
And I can understand why.
There's some nice hypothetical questions here. I don't know what you think about these. The violent pacifist says, if wages were irrelevant, in which team from any country, league or era would you most like to have been a squad player in, Simon?
Well, it certainly wouldn't be now.
Really?
Too much attention, I suppose. Too many commercial issues. I think that there was a period where football... there was a period a long time ago when footballers earned no money and a lot of them would prefer to... prefer any other job, really. And I'll leave that out of it. I think probably the late 70s, early 80s, maybe that Nottingham Forest team. Ooh. You know, the story of Brian Clough before the 1979 League Cup final, forcing the night before the final... got all his players in for a pre-match team talk and forced them all to drink champagne. And if one of them said he didn't like champagne, so he went out and bought him 10 pints of bitter and forced them all to stay there until they were totally wrecked. And then the following day, they won the League Cup final.
They did have a very bad first half, though, didn't they? I think they were losing at half-time.
And then came back to win 3-2.
Yeah.
And they just must have felt like they were unbeatable.
What was the thinking behind that?
It's hard to see, but you've just got to imagine that period in that particular team's life where they win the English League title, they win back-to-back European titles. That's just, they must have felt amazing. So I fancy a bit of that. I'd also quite like to have watched Zico train. I'd quite like to have been in Zico's team.
Yeah, in a similar way, I think I'd pick Maradona's Napoli because, on the field they're having a right old time and off it they were having a right old time. My word. And what about you, Ian?
Well, I have a similar fascination for English football in the 1970s, but as Simon's already covered that, and we're talking about essentially not playing football as a squad player, then I would take the Hawaiian League and just, enjoy the climate.
Right.
Yeah.
Paul?
I think I have to, on similar lines, I think the culture, football culture of the 1970s would be far too macho for me.
Oh.
I think I'd struggle. I'd probably get wedgies. So I think Guardiola's Barcelona side, right, which is well remunerated. You're set up for life. You don't have to worry about that. But you can also be a bit, you know, hoity-toity cultural as well.
Nice.
I'd like that.
Very good. Equally, Evan G says, assuming he had the ability to pull this off in a game, if you could nutmeg anyone in history, etc., 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 who would it be?
Well, and tempting as it is to say Franz Beckenbauer or one of the great defenders, you kind of think that you'd want to inflict it back on the people who do it to others. So I'd probably go for a Maradona or a Ronaldo.
Right.
Give him a taste of it.
Really?
Yeah, Cristiano Ronaldo would leap out, just so you can see him do that grin he does when he's been made to look silly. And he does a grin that says, it doesn't matter. Yeah, you all just saw me dive, it doesn't matter. I'm still me, and you're still you, so the situation's fine with me. I'd like to see that grin.
It's a great topless shot of Cristiano Ronaldo today. I don't know if you've seen that. Black and white.
Not.
Very, very tasteful. Nice. Paul?
Robbie Savage, four times.
Because he'd see the lighter side, yeah? Somebody answered Roy Keane, and that's a pretty top answer. Ooh, one question that we had, and I'm not sure who it was from, but someone, I think you might have an answer, is whether the team that finishes... is whether, if the winner of the Europa League has already qualified elsewhere for the Champions League, whether that Champions League spot will go to the runner-up in the Europa League. And Simon, what have you been able to find out?
I've combed through the Europa League regulations, and there's no provision for that place being given to anyone else. And the only way that the runners-up in the Europa League could benefit, could take any of the winners' benefits, is if the winners of the Europa League don't fancy or are busy in some way when the Super Cup is played. The runners-up can step in to that.
So there's a provision for that,
yeah,
but not for them to take part in the Champions League itself, which suggests that that's not what they're planning at all.
Indeed. There is no provision for that at all. Yes, and also the only other interesting qualifying Europa League qualifying thing that I could find in that document was that if a team qualifies for, in a sporting sense, qualifies for the Europa League and just doesn't fancy playing it, then their place doesn't go to anyone else in their country. They can just... there is provision there for a team deciding that they're not going to bother, thank you.
And would that affect your coefficient over time?
It would, yeah.
Interesting. All right, here's Blues in the USA asking, what's the best alternative to penalties and away goals deciding a knockout game? See, I'm not sure that they actually need changing, but a lot of people think they might. Style points, he suggests, as decided by four judges, as in strictly. Most nutmegs in a game, shots on goal, least number of yellow cards. Or here's Juventitre coming in, which is a name particularly relevant, of course, to this week's ruling. But anyway, he says, how about knockout matches being decided by penalties taken at both ends simultaneously? Yeah, it would make for major drama with fans effectively knowing the outcome before the players. You know, you'd blow a whistle and both ends they take a... That's a great idea.
Television.
It would.
But it would be confusing, surely, for the referee.
It wouldn't make
for
good need
television. You've got more than one official, and it's not a difficult job. Did it go in, did it not... go in.
Did the ref? It made for massively bad drama. I mean, no pressure building up on teams and being passed from one end to the next. You wouldn't be able to concentrate on one moment at a time.
Yes, yeah, it's the pauses between the penalty kicks which are so that, they're the
therein lies the drama. Yeah. Okay, well, how about this, which is a suggestion a colleague of mine is very fond of? You take the penalties before the match, and they only become effective if the game is then drawn or drawn on aggregate.
I like the way it is now. Yep. I like the cruelty and the nastiness. I like the fact that one human being will be crushed forever by the weight of circumstance. That's what appeals to me about football.
So yeah, I think that you could still have the cruelty and the nastiness and the human drama if you had a they shoot horses, don't they, style golden goal, where you just kept on playing until somebody scored a goal.
But that would make for very, very long matches.
Yeah, I mean, to begin with, and that in itself would be fascinating.
But you could augment
this. I don't think it would, though.
I think it would. I mean, I think, you know, think of all those nerd boys out there who watch football on the internet.
Effectively, what you're talking about exists. It's sudden death overtime, no?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they do that in American sports.
But you could speed this up.
We don't do it in football.
Right.
If every 2 minutes...
And it can go on and on. I remember Boston Bruins' Stanley Cup win. This is way back in, I think, 89 or something, where you know, the players literally could not stand up by,
that's brilliant.
By the end that's of whatever what period, about. The 12th period of extra time.
But what if you took off one player from each team every 2 minutes and
or
started...
one item of clothing per minute.
But, sexy extra time.
Yeah,
extra time.
The best method of all, surely, is
you're
the
welcome,
replay and should be used wherever possible.
What's that?
The replay.
Oh.
I would quite like to see the World Cup extended by a week, say, just to give a little bit more space between matches. There's right. no need to play every two, three days,
yep.
which tires teams out and affects their following performances. If you were to just extend that knockout stage by a bit, matches that are drawn could be replayed 48 hours later and we'd have another chance of a proper sporting outcome.
A week extension to the 2022 World Cup would give us a Christmas Day World Cup final.
Brilliant.
Who wouldn't enjoy that?
Right. Actually, we did have Craig Munro asking about the practicalities beyond all the questions of how the bid was assigned, etc. But the practicality of hosting a World Cup in December, frankly, I don't know. I'm more worried about the next one.
I think, well, football's a winter sport. The World Cup is the greatest competition in football. It should always be played in winter. The Summer World Cups are a bit of a travesty. You know, a lot of teams can't play the kind of football they want to play because right. of the temperature, obviously. So I say every World Cup in December, unless it's being hosted in a Southern Hemisphere country, in which case you revert to June.
Right, or a country where it's in the Northern Hemisphere, but it's so plain hot even in December that effectively it's like playing it in summer.
Well, indeed.
Yeah. It's a very simple rule. I can't think of a better Christmas, though, than watching a World Cup all the way over Christmas. I know it's supposed to finish on the 17th or 18th, but imagine if it went all the way through to New Year's Eve. That would be wonderful.
A Christmas Day World Cup final would be awesome.
Yeah. Even a Christmas Day group stage, you know, one of those four games on the same day thing. Oof. Oh, avoid the family.
Oh, my goodness. Are we actually now looking forward to the Qatar World Cup? We are, secretly. Yeah, we've all thought, you know what, that's actually going to be really fun.
Just dark nights, live football. I mean, come on.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
It's a bit like, you know...
We've not been on a fact-finding trip to Qatar or anything, listeners, just in case you thought. This is just us, you know, talking. Anyway, sorry, Ian, you were going to say something.
It's just... I mean, yes, you're absolutely right. There's nothing inherently wrong with having a Winter World Cup. It will be absolutely fine. It may even be lots and lots of fun.
That's
it's just
not the issue.
An awful lot of things to leave behind, isn't it? You know, it's a bit like robbing a bank and then saying, ah, but look at all the good we can do with the money.
Right, yeah. Okay, let's get some answers now. Martin Greenan comes to our rescue on the subject of how you get promoted from the Scottish Championship. One team, in this case Hearts, goes up automatically from the Scottish Championship. There's a playoff between the second, third and fourth teams who include in their playoff quartet the team that finishes 11th in the Scottish Premier League, i.e. second bottom in the Scottish Premier League. Right. Top knowledge as ever, Maestros, he says with a cheeky exclamation mark. Top knowledge to you, Martin Greenham. GPM, retweeting James Moore, who may have started this, says, does David Beckham being born at Whips Cross Hospital count as nominative determinism? I think it probably does. Very nice. Ars Technica, on a similar theme, applauds our mentioning of Club Bruges last week, but they add, how did you miss their wonderfully named lad, Bolly Bolingoli Mbombo, who scored 2 goals against Besiktas? You'd be forgiven for thinking he's a striker, but no, that's just his cousin, Romelu Lukaku, who was also from the Bolingoli family. We should all hope he's destined for greatness with a name like that. Who doesn't like saying Bolly Bolingoli? Nobody, I don't think. Would you want to have a go?
Bolling, bolling, bolly.
There you go. And here's Jazz Horse with the most interesting post of the week. Speaking of JPT trophies, pin numbers, ATM machines and the like... You should note that adding lake to Lake Windermere is pointless too because mere means lake. Yeah? Likewise, Sahara in Arabic means desert. So when you call it the Sahara Desert, you're actually saying the desert desert.
Oh, idiots.
All this time, listeners.
I like Lake Windy Lake, though.
Lake Windy Lake.
I'm all over that.
Right, okay.
Lake Windy Lake.
Right, I will.
Would you, oh, my big
and finally, I'm just going to shuffle up my papers and do... And finally... There we go. There is this other one from Langdon Lee, which Ben was very keen on. I wasn't sure if it was a little bit too left field, but anyway, I'll ask it and see what you think. Langdon Lee says, if you had to wear one team's mascot outfit, who would it be? Mine would be Plymouth. Just refresh my memory, what's the Plymouth mascot?
He's a, like a pirate, a pilgrim. He's All a pilgrim. Right. With a, he's got an amazing handlebar
moustache. How do you dress up like a pilgrim? You're all in black and stuff, is it?
Well, you just wear an enormous pilgrim costume.
Oh, okay.
I think you'd have to go for Gunnosaurus, wouldn't you? But just go about your daily business as if nothing was odd. Get on the bus, go to the library, you know.
Right, much as Gunnosaurus himself does.
Yes, yeah. I think he does. In certain parts of North London, right. You can see him perambulating.
Not I have heard that there's more than one Gunnosaurus, but tell me that's not true.
No.
Right.
God, that would be ridiculous.
That would be ridiculous. He might have a brother or something. You could go for... Here's some suggestions from Ben Green. I don't know, Paul, would you like... Cyril the Swan of Swansea, who once, you recall, ripped the head off Millwall's Zampa the Lion in 2001.
I would like to be a mascot with a long neck, for sure.
Okay. Well,
Cyril the Swan's costume looks particularly awkward to wear because he's got... The human's eyes peep out from the very base of the swan's neck.
Right.
And the swan's neck then extends way above his head. And you just imagine that balancing would be an issue there.
I was a mascot once at a charity football tournament at Stamford Bridge.
Did you have to wear a costume?
I did. It was a giant dragon. Not that dissimilar from Gunnosaurus, to be fair. This was about 10 years ago when I was a feature writer for a charity.
What was the most
magazine.
Difficult thing you found about it?
Well, the sweat was the main thing. Right. I mean, it's not just a pile of material. There's actually an internal superstructure that holds the whole thing together. Mm. And on a hot day on Stamford Bridge, having a kickabout with Ewan Griffith, the sweat builds up quite quickly. You start to get in your eyes and in your mouth. Everything.
And you can't wipe your eyes, clearly. Because you've got very, very
short hands, you see, and a lot of weight, and children usually hanging off your tail as well. It was a hard day, but I got the interview, and that's all that counted.
Absolutely. Admirable stuff from Ian Simon. Of course, you've got that bear costume good to go if anybody...
It is really sweaty. I can testify to that.
In other mascot fighting news, because I mentioned Cyril the Swan ripping the head off Zampa the Lion, Wolves Wolfie once started a fight with all three of Bristol City's pigs.
Yeah.
Talk about manifest destiny. He also had a fight. He's a scrappy one, it's Wolfie, with West Brom's Baggy Bird. I didn't know that West Brom had a mascot called Baggy Bird. A little bit of work on that name, I'm thinking.
We've got two at Southend. Sammy the Shrimp and Elvis the Eel. But the old Sammy the Shrimp used to be this sort of 7-8 foot pink thing with stick-on eyes that would get merciless abuse
from
away
supporters.
That's a bit
scary, isn't it?
Well, do you remember when they had the mascot Grand National? They'd get 92 gram mascots lined up to jump over fences and stuff. Poor old Sammy the Shrimp, the guy in there couldn't move his legs any more than sort of, you know, 6 inches apart from each other.
Right.
So we came in after about an hour, having fallen over absolutely everything. And it was at that point that Southend decided to update and rebrand.
Right.
So there is a cupboard. Yes, they've got Elvis the Eel and a Sammy the Shrimp, but they're more manoeuvrable.
With
his
monopod,
shorts.
How does he jump?
Very carefully. He's basically just an eel head. But everything else is free-flowing.
Okay.
Specifically designed, I think, to avoid a recurrence of the mascot Grand National disaster.
All right. What did Norwich have?
Captain Canary. So at least, I mean, it's obvious, but at least we've got a name that's other than the name of the club. He's a captain. He's actually got authority, carries stature within the community.
Right. Pretty Spain was just asking if Italian teams have them, and I really don't think they have. I mean, Lazio have a genuine, real-life eagle called Olimpia, which flies around the Stadio Olimpico before matches and generally returns to its holder's arm, but on at least one occasion didn't, sparking a bit of panic. And the other were Juve, who are ever ones to be kind of hip to the whole marketing side of things, introduced a mascot in a proper costume. This, I think, was in the late 90s, early 2000s, but they kind of missed the point because they called the mascot Alex. You remember Alex Del Piero was there, so they had Alex, and it was a big kind of pupazzo, as they say, like, you know, big kind of...
caricature.
Yeah, like a kind of cuddly version of Alex Del Piero. And he's not there, I don't think, anymore. Maybe he is. At least Juventini listeners, maybe he is still there, I don't know. Anyway, of course, in foreign lands, for example, in Germany, you've got animal mascots like Henness the Eighth, who's been having a rough old time of it there of late, but... in the Bundesliga. Sorry, Simon, were you going to say something?
No.
Okay, who was going to say something? Pretty Ben saying,
somebody,
shut up.
Somebody wants us to talk about Hengist the Monkey, the Hartlepool mascot.
Oh, crikey, yeah.
He was elected mayor, wasn't he?
He was a fraud.
Why was he a fraudian?
Well, because he ran on a campaign ticket of being Hangus the Monkey and things like handing free bananas to school children and things like that. But when he won, he took off the monkey outfit and he was a serious politician and he didn't carry through with the things that he was proposing.
How funny, because that's a direct reversal of what usually happens in elections. Am I right, listeners? Yeah. Am I right? A little bit of politics. That's it for today's Football Weekly Extra. But there's more Football Weekly to come this week involving the Max, Paul McKinney's Ian McIntosh. Simon, you coming along Friday?
I am doing the minute-by-minute of the England game.
Oh, right.
So,
well, we'll be reading your output.
Chained to a keyboard.
We'll be across your stream, as it were.
Marvellous. Yeah, cross that stream.
Don't cross the stream.
You choose.
We'll cross that stream when we come to it.
No, but I think the whole point is you don't ever want to cross the streams. Am I right, Ian?
That would be bad.
Yeah. Right, well, that's it. Anyway, thanks so much for being here today, Simon. The event to which I was referring is the Football Weekly Live, which is happening in London Friday night. See you there, Paul.
Thank you.
See you there, Ian. Maybe see you there, listeners, as if there were any tickets still left available if you don't already have one. Actually, there might be. I'm not sure. Producer Ben will be there too. Many thanks to him. Thanks to everyone. Have yourself... Oh, Philippe Auclair is going to be with us. Have yourself... So it's a night off for you two boys. Have yourself a super weekend of international football. And we'll be back to refresh your memory of it all on Monday. Bye for now.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the renowned website builder that helps you share your story with the world in the most beautiful way. Establish a personal brand, portfolio, or e-commerce store at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off. Thank you.